Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on karma and rebirth. These are two fundamental teachings of the Buddha that are often misunderstood and misapplied. This talk is recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 1st, 2016. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you.
This morning's talk is on karma and rebirth. Two very misunderstood concepts, at least as far as the Buddha taught karma and rebirth. Let me read the article rather than preface it. The Buddha's quote on karma from the Anguttara Nikaya: "I am the owner of my actions, the heir to my actions. I am born of my actions and related through my actions. My actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life." He's getting right to the heart of the Dhamma and his teachings. How we think and how we act is going to determine our experience. Karma and rebirth are closely linked concepts of the Buddha's teachings. Despite modern presentations that the Buddha taught karma and rebirth only to relate to the prevalent beliefs of his time and are not useful or relevant teachings, understanding karma and rebirth is essential to these teachings. There's a lot of modern Buddhists, and especially some pretty significant modern Buddhist teachers, and I'll speculate a little bit, I think just because they don't understand how it was presented, discount the importance of understanding karma and rebirth, because they say that the Buddha only taught it because it was such a common teaching of the time, and he just included it. And I'll develop it a little bit. The truth is that the Buddha clarified karma and rebirth and related it to the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha's teachings on karma and rebirth refuted many of the common beliefs of his time and helped clarify the purpose and experience of awakening. Understanding these teachings as they were originally presented and in the context of the Four Noble Truths brings insight and clarity to the Eightfold Path and can help one recognize contradictory and confusing Buddhist teachings that are later developed adaptations and accommodations to the original teachings. Karma and rebirth are conditions arising from ignorance. Remember that through dependent origination, it's not a general ignorance. The Buddha is not saying, and I'm not saying, that as human beings we're just ignorant. But what we're lacking is understanding. We're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths and how they apply to our lives. Karma is in no way punishment as a result of arbitrary judgments from a supreme being. Karma is not the consequences from a vague, independent, moral, ethical, spiritual system. Karma is not a condition imposed on us. You alone are the cause of your karma, and you alone are the cause of rebirth. Karma should not be viewed simply as what is unfolding in our lives. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by your present state of understanding and quality of mindfulness. I'm going to reread that. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by your present state of understanding or your present state of mindfulness and the quality of that mindfulness. As your present state of mindfulness and understanding animate your current actions are moderating the effects of past actions. Is that clear?
Just read that last one again.
I will. As your present state of mindfulness and understanding animate your current actions are moderating the effects of past actions. That's a little bit of a discursive sentence, isn't it? So what it means is that if we are continuing to live our lives rooted in ignorance, meaning ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, and we're not developing right view, meaning of the way to see reality clearly in ourselves in relation to what's occurring, then our mindfulness will simply be stuck in that recurring conditioned state of mind. And because of that, our resulting actions will simply continue the karmic path that we're on. As we deepen our understanding, and our concentration deepens, and our mindfulness becomes framed by the Eightfold Path, in other words, we start developing right view, then we can use the situation that's unfolding, no matter what it is, and incline our minds towards awakening. So our present state of mindfulness is moderating the effects of past intentional actions. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. It's really a key understanding of the Buddhist teachings, and it's a key understanding of this talk today.
John, can you use another word other than moderating?
I know you said that a few times. You don't like that, but
I'll try to. No, I didn't say I didn't like it.
I will try to. Let me tell you why I use it first. Moderating is something that we do that has an effect on what's occurring. So another word might be impacting. So the present state of our understanding impacts what's occurring, and so that could be it. Could be anything. We could be someone who's disturbed by cars going by, and we react to cars going by, especially when we're trying to be quiet. And so that's affecting the quality of our experience right now, isn't it? Rather than just it's just what's occurring. Cars are going by. We're accepting what's going on in our lives. So our minds aren't reacting to it. So the effect of that conditioned thinking that I don't like to hear any sounds when I'm meditating, especially cars going by, causes a reaction. That's a past conditioned thought that is moderated or impacted by the present level of our mindfulness. And if our mindfulness is such that I'm accepting what's occurring, there will be no reaction to the car going by. And so we will not create a further agitated mind state, meaning more karmic condition and thinking. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So, more, is that a little bit better way of using that word?
The only reason I ask that, I don't know that I've heard you use the word moderate before. So maybe I haven't, I don't recall. But it some words, just like they, I understand the concept. This is a teaching we've had many times here before. But sometimes a word just isn't like clicking in a brain. So that's why I just asked you
to give
some other, you know, there are always synonyms for words. Mm-hmm. So that's all. So I just was wondering if you could ask any more.
So is that clear where I've gotten and I'm trying to think of a more descriptive word than moderate.
It doesn't have to be more descriptive.
Yeah. So, I mean, and a simple way of saying...
gang up on you, John, but impact is a good word to use.
Thank you. A simple way of looking at it is the way that what I'm holding in mind right now is going to determine my experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the real teaching of... Or it's getting to the root of what... of the Buddhist teachings and my teachings on karma. What we're holding in mind at any point, forget about everything in the Eightfold Path and all the things that we're talking about, what I'm holding in mind right now is going to determine my experience of what's occurring. So if my mind is such that I'm thinking, I can't wait till I'm out of here, I have something really important to get to, you'll notice it too, won't you? You'll see, well, he's not really present with us here, isn't he? And if you're feeling that way, you won't be present with what's occurring. If your mind is thinking about this nice lunch I'm going to have or my nice dinner that I'm going to have later on tonight, we're out of the present moment. We're not well concentrated in what's occurring. So it's taken in those terms, it's very easy to see how the present level of our mindfulness is going to impact the quality of our life in this as our life occurs. Now, taking into account that first part of it, past intentional actions are driving what we're experiencing right now. And so as that, a term that's often used in the teaching is that as our karma ripens, meaning as it comes into fruition in this moment, if my mind is well concentrated, I'm holding in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path, then what's occurring right now will continue and I can use it to develop awakening because there will be no resistance. I'll simply be observing what's occurring and I'll understand it in the proper context. Well, this is the way I'm seeing this and the way I'm experiencing it is either part of my conditioned thinking that I can recognize, or I've let go of the conditioning around whatever is occurring, and then I'm simply experiencing life as it is, and I'm seeing things clearly. And it's an entirely practical teaching. It's not something esoteric or mystical in any way. It's a very clear teaching on how to perceive what's occurring in our lives and understanding that if I'm reacting to it in any way, it's part of conditioned thinking. So another way of another word for karma is conditioned thinking. Another word for karma is anatta, or not self. Another way to understand karma is to take a look in the mirror Because karma is what's occurring to us right now, and it's how we perceive ourselves. And that, I think I'm going to get off the talk because I'm on the roll now. The second factor that's so important, and these are very closely linked factors, karma and rebirth. We've just talked about, and I've just explained, how the present level of my mindfulness is going to affect how I'm experiencing my life. Another way of saying that is the present level of my mindfulness is going to give birth to the next moment. That's how we are. That's how our thinking creates what's occurring. And I'm not talking in a grand cosmic sense that my next thought is going to create the universe, but my next thought is going to create me in relation to the universe. It's going to create my experience. And that's the most important teaching on rebirth. It has nothing to do with what might happen in a future life. The most important teaching on rebirth is what I'm giving birth to in the next moment. And that is determined by what I'm holding in mind and how I'm reacting or responding to past conditional thinking. Another way of saying that, responding to my karma. So karma can either be something that continues to take me down the road to more confusion, delusion, and suffering, or through the refined mindfulness that's rooted in concentration, I can recognize it and utilize it towards awakening.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had this thought this morning about the ego, and that somewhat in relation to this idea of karma and rebirth, but that, you know, the ego is just, karma's always going to be there. It's a phenomenon of being human.
Yep.
And rebirth is always going to be there, right? The rebirth of each moment. And so, and your ego is always going to be there, but it's really this quality, the quality of what it is, and whether it is, you know, what level of delusion your ego is in or trying to create in each moment. I mean, there's some, I don't want to say that, I don't know if I should, it's not, I know you said, you know, there's, the Buddha doesn't talk about there being some essence or anything, but if we're just speaking simply of the purpose of what the ego is, you know, in a human being for, there, at some point there is like the basic purpose of what the ego is without all of this confusion and delusion and conditions.
Yep.
It's just simply like
just a function of your mind
in the world. So you don't walk into a tree or something or whatnot. It's very functional, but and karma in the same way has that. It can be a very beautiful thing that's directed towards the Eightfold Path or whatever spiritual path one person might have. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I just wanted to hear myself talk.
I did too. So thank you for that. That you're. The ego, an awakened human being hasn't lost an ego, and if you want to use the word essence, then it would point to the idea that the ego is simply a function of the mind, rather than something that is in control of the mind. And another way of saying that, something that is stuck on continued I make or mm-hmm. continued selfing, because it is that another way of saying anatta. Karma, conditioned thinking, it's part of continued eye-making. And that's what drives karma towards more unsatisfactory experiences. Mm-hmm. When we interrupt that continued eye-making through the Eightfold Path, that's the only reason the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, was to do that. We're impacting, adjusting our karma towards awakening. We're creating in ourselves, another way for saying that is we're creating in our own minds, in our own lives, the conditions for awakening. There's a lot of talk too about conditions in modern Buddhism. The only condition we should be concerned about is what conditions am I creating in my life? Mm-hmm. And that condition should be towards awakening. The dependent origination describes the conditions that are necessary. Dependent means necessary, required, to lead to suffering. And if we can recognize that, and that's conditioned thinking, if we can interrupt conditioned thinking, then we interrupt the process that leads to confusion, delusion, and suffering. That's, again, another word for karma.
It's as if, like, I don't know, there's some level of, like, a healing process or something when you decide to take to the path where it is this unraveling of conditions that are negative or leading you towards more suffering, and then, you know, so you kind of like filling up your bank with these conditions that are inclined towards the Eightfold Path or inclined towards mindfulness. But I think it's just, for me anyway, it's sort of funny because the process of letting go of these past conditions that are not healthy or whatnot, within that process, I start developing this condition that's like, conditions are not good, or like keep letting go of condition, you know, when, like, naturally I'm just starting to see that, you know, some are useful, then there are these ones that are useful, like, I'll keep these in my basket, like, because that's actually helpful now. And
yeah.
So, but it's just so interesting how we're just still, like, yeah, how complicated.
Yeah, those conditions.
How complicated we've made things for ourselves.
Again, because of that, the conditioned thinking. So the conditions that we should keep in our bank are the conditions that are described by the Eightfold Path, beginning with right view.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's there. That's what's... Jean.
That's what keeps coming back to me, that, and so much of what I got out of the book was around right view. And just to stop and say, am I operating from the perspective of right view, or is my ego running amok? And at that point in time, you know, a switch can or cannot be made. And the result of that is the karmic result.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a beautiful description of it. Karma is a result of what we're thinking and how we're acting, either in accordance with the Eightfold Path or disregarding it, or not even knowing anything about it.
You know. John, another thing I wanted to mention is that for me, a very important and relevant piece is around right speech, specifically how I speak to myself.
Yes.
So, you know, right thought, speech, and right view together are very empowering.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's one of the most important aspects of right speech. It's certainly important to recognize how we're talking to other people. That'll describe the state of our consciousness to ourselves. But also to be very mindful of the thoughts that I'm holding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the... And it's ultimately letting go of ignorant views that develops the conditions for awakening. And those ignorant views are easily recognizable when we've developed the concentration to be able to see what I'm saying to myself. What am I holding in my own mind in relation to myself? Let me go on just a little bit further. This touches on an important part of karma too, that, let me read it and then I'll... All of the events of life are not the result of individual karma. Most of what occurs in one's life is simply worldly conditions and described in the First Noble Truth. There is stress, or there is dukkha, or dukkha occurs. Reaction to impersonal events will create additional karma and further conditions the mind. So karma is often portrayed today as things that just naturally occur in life. In other words, you might get caught in a natural disaster, the river floods. And you look at that, well, that's just my bad karma. Sometimes karma is portrayed like that. It's like this cloud hanging over our heads. When the river floods and it messes up our house or our car, that's part of worldly causes and conditions. It's not personal. In that sense, it's not karma. It's just part of worldly causes and conditions. But if we look at it as personal, if we look at it as punishment, we're simply creating more I-making, aren't I? When something that is part of the natural occurrence in the world that I take personal, that's obviously more I-making, it's furthering delusional karma. And it's important to recognize that. Part of being in the world, part of that First Noble Truth, is that there is going to be dukkha. There's going to be unsatisfactory experiences. There's going to be suffering. And none of that is personal. It's just part of being here. And it's an important aspect of giving that, of understanding the... all of these teachings, because if I can experience what would otherwise be a negative experience and simply see it clearly, this didn't happen to me, it just happened because I'm living in the world, then I'm not creating any more karma, I'm not creating any more conditioned thinking over it, am I? It's just part of being here. And that when you really take that to the ultimate point of right view, then we realize that there's nothing that I need to take personally except the way that I talk to myself and see myself in relation to the world.
The way that I react.
Yes.
That's the only thing that is personal.
Yes, that's and it shows very clearly where I'm taking it personal, or I wouldn't be reacting to it. And so we do that a lot. I mean, we can get caught up in all kinds of things that people get caught up in, the economy or politics or the world is in a really difficult state, but not much worse than it was during the Buddha's time. But if we react to it and take it personally, we're creating in this very important teaching, we're creating more karma over it rather than just letting life be as it is more.
So can I give a very immediate example?
Sure, please.
And this is, again, just from my own experience, the way that I work with some of this. So say in that, and my memory is poor, so I won't be able to state it exactly. But when I said something about, could you give another word, then moderate, and you said something back to me, and I said something, like I was reactive. And then I had some agitation in my mind. And I looked at, for me, what can I be with? Like, and it's, being maybe wrong or confused. Like, just like kind of turning toward that. And there was this sense of like ease and spaciousness and concentration and contentment. So like, and then like it was all, so that was my own, you know, generating this I can't be wrong here, you know, and I didn't say that, you know, and that was inside of me. It wasn't in relation to what you said. That just gave me an opportunity to see my I'm making impermanent thoughts that create tension in the mind and in the body. And like, it's okay, I can be wrong.
Responsibility.
You know, and it was like this, just this blissful feeling of ease and openness. And
yeah, that's a good description of being present. Blissfulness.
And like concentration, you know, drops in.
Concentration drops in because you're not, a reaction is a distraction too.
Yeah.
The Buddha could just as almost accurately describe the first noble truth, not there as dukkha, is there as distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And that distraction occurs because I don't want what's occurring to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be even something as what's occurring is I finished a piece of chocolate cake and I need more.
Yes.
That's a distraction. Or in my case, I just finished 3 bottles of vodka and I need one more. 3 wasn't enough. And we do that with our lives. It's always, our minds are always into the what's the next thing. What does my ego need? What does what does anatta need to keep it distracted and keep it satisfied? It's always in the future. It's always, Maura and I used to go to this restaurant, we still might go occasionally, in Lambertville. It's a really good Thai restaurant. But the owner of the place is always looking at the next customer is going to be his big customer that's going to pay off his mortgage. And he lets you be known that, you know, it's he kind of rushes you through the meal because he wants that table for the next well-paying customer. And it's a little bit...
We used to joke about it.
I mean, it's a really good restaurant, so we go back there. But it's just a good example. It's the next moment. You know, always something has to satisfy this ego, and we create this conditioned thinking that it's never satisfied because it can't be. But when the ego then, when we become awakened, or even as we're moving towards that, then we recognize that the ego is simply a function of the mind. It keeps us from walking in the trees. And a well-developed, well-concentrated mind then makes useful and wise decisions because it understands worldly causes and conditions. So just a little bit more I want to read from this. The Buddha's words again. Karma should be understood correctly. The cause of karma should be understood. The diversity of the results of karma should be understood. And what that means is that we're creating a lot of chaos in our lives through our karma because we've now lost control of our minds through that reaction. The diversity means that anything can occur now. When the Buddha talks about developing awakening, he talks about developing a well-concentrated mind, meaning that we now can control what we think when we think it. We've stopped creating chaos in our outer lives because there's no more chaos in our inner lives. Another way of saying well-concentrated. Cessation of karma should be understood. The path developing the cessation of karma should be understood, meaning the Eightfold Path. So again, remember that the Buddha didn't teach the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path at every sutta. In fact, he doesn't. In the suttas, it's not mentioned a lot. It's talked about when he first gave his first teaching, and then it's referenced. But most of his teachings don't reference directly the Eightfold Path. In other words, he doesn't describe it. But he's talking about how to develop the Eightfold Path. And one of the problems with... I'm sorry about keep going back here. One of the problems with modern Buddhism is they don't use the suttas to teach Buddhism. They use a conceptual example and explanation of how we should be if we could develop the Eightfold Path. But we can't develop the Eightfold Path. It's like Dorothy on the Yellow Brick Road. If she didn't follow the Yellow Brick Road, she never would have got... Wherever she got to, I forgot how it ends. You got to know the path if you're going to get to, if you're going to walk the path. You can't disregard the yellow brick road and walk the orange brick road and expect to get to the same place. They're two different things.
There's just something so valuable, I think, you know, in stories and how we, you know, we learn through story. How that's been. I feel like that's part of our nature as humans, to learn through stories, and that you know, why would that change?
Yeah.
I mean, we still do learn through story, you know, but a good story, there's good stories and there's bad stories that are convoluted, unfortunately.
That must be a good story because I'm still thinking about it.
Well, and I don't know if I'm understanding you correctly, but how do I say this? Not everything fits into... the Dhamma, in a sense. Like, narrative is okay, you know, if that's just what's occurring, but it's what we attach to narrative. If it's... So...
I guess I was just... I think I went with what John was saying about modern Buddhism and how the teaching is not straight from the suttas or the stories. That the teaching, the Buddha taught through the stories, correct? Through the suttas, that's how he taught.
Yep, those are his teachings.
That's what you were referring to.
Yeah, that modern, you were saying that modern Buddhism doesn't teach from this, well, not being critical. I was really just saying I learn really well from, my ego learns really well from listening to the suttas that have a lesson to them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Let me just clarify before we go on, because I thought you were talking about stories in life, like the narrative of our life, like how
we learn from
metaphor and story. So that's all. I was totally confused.
Yeah. No, that's
so
okay.
I'm sorry. When we talk about the suttas, I've never thought of them as stories.
Okay.
You know,
In the sense that they're recounting, they're the storytelling of what occurred. Mm-hmm. So a lot of many of the suttas are Ananda's accounting that he first gave at the first Buddhist council. And the sutta begins with, "Thus have I heard."
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good way of saying that. I never really looked at it that way, but the Ananda's now telling to the... Now think about the council. There's 500 awakened monks there and some nuns. I'm trying to clarify, to find out true, but I think there had to be some nuns there at that point. And so the Ananda gets up and he starts telling a story of this sutta. But it's a factual story and it was checked. The reason why we know that the Pali Canon is still authentic today is it was checked against the memory of 500 other well-concentrated awakened human beings. And it would not be included in the Pali Canon that we have today if they didn't agree that, yes, this is how I heard that story. It's a great way of saying it. But there's also a lot of use of metaphor that the Buddha used, but in a metaphor in a direct way. In other words, when the Buddha's talking about Mara, the malevolent god that's coming after us and making us crazy, that's a metaphor. The Buddha wasn't talking that there's actually some god that's doing this. There's not, but he's using that as a metaphorical reference to the way that we think and the way that we create hurtful stories in our own minds. Great discussion.
I have a question. In that last passage you were reading about the cessation of karma, I want to make sure I'm clear on what the cessation of karma would mean, that because your past... So karma is basically the result of past actions and thoughts. Basically, where you are now is the result of my having... Where I am now, I drove to Frenchtown.
Yes.
And the cessation of karma would mean... I'm not sure what the cessation of karma would mean, because you would think that karma was always there because you're always present somewhere or in some state of mind that you arrived at.
Yes, it's such an important question.
Of past states of mind.
Yep. So one aspect of karma, a practical aspect, is that you impacted your unfolding of karma by deciding to come here today. That's part of your karma. And it was partly influenced by what you've done in your whole life, but you could also say in the past 6, 8, 10 months, developing your understanding. If you didn't start developing an understanding of the Dhamma, there'd be nothing would have driven you here. But your experience also, I mean, another part of that is your experience of what's occurring now that you've driven to Frenchtown and come to this class is your past conditioned thinking. And so, and when we put ourselves in the environment, I gave the talk last week on the importance of skillful associations, meaning to be part of a sangha, and what to talk about when you're in the sangha. The Buddha talked very clearly about that. You talk about the Dhamma. So we've put ourselves in a place where we're likely to hear, in the sutta it's called sober talk, but talk about the Dhamma, so that we can further our awakening, full mature experience, and to bring karma to cessation. Now, what does that mean? It means that we have fully developed the Eightfold Path. And so the Buddha, the best description is the Buddha. The Buddha awakened when he was 35 years old. He was a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And yet his past intentional acts were still motivating his present life. But he was moderating or impacting his karma because he was now an awakened human being and he wasn't contributing any more karma. So you can say that he ceased creating more karma, but because of past intentional actions, he was still driven by those past actions. And that part... We're really getting into something that is almost not, it's almost inconsequential, but just to recognize that there's remnants of our conditioned thinking that will still continue to drive us. Yes, but if we're holding in mind the principles of a well-concentrated mind that is framed by the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, then the karma that's unfolding in this moment will continue to move towards awakening and will no longer be possible to move us off the path.
So, for example, what I did when I was 16, I would, like, you know, when I'm fully awakened,
next week,
probably.
I 5 years later, I run into the friend that I, you know, talked poorly of when I was 16 for some reason at the grocery store. I run into her, and then so it's like my karma from then all of a sudden meets me in the future, right? Even though I'm fully awakened, but I'll be able to kind of resolve that.
That's a perfect example of karma unfolding, yes. Yeah. But if your mind was still so conditioned that you were still harboring ill will towards
right.
that person,
right.
20 years later, and you meet that person and you say, I remember when you did this to me, you blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You've just created more additional karma, didn't you?
Yeah, instead of just, you know, shake her hand and greet her like a whatever, however it would unfold to where.
And getting back, hold on one second.
Came up then, like just to say, Martin awakening. If it was me, and like, oh, this feeling of discomfort comes up. I can recognize that as not self.
Yes.
Yeah, this is not me. This is not mine. And getting back to what Mary brought up.
And be at peace with me.
Because of your well-developed concentration and your refined mindfulness, seeing things through right view, then you're no longer creating any more karma. But your past karma brought that situation to this present moment.
But it's interesting because we're talking, like, even though, because I think it's confusing because it's saying ceasing karma, but yet we still have karma unfolding, but it's referring to the past karma that was done unconsciously or something, or without being awakened.
Yes,
when
and that,
that statement is referring to that specifically.
Yes, it's so perceptive. Thank you for bringing all this up. The Buddha's teaching something in context.
Yeah.
He's not teaching a cosmic understanding. He's teaching it in context of developing the Eightfold Path. And the point of the Eightfold Path and developing understanding of the Four Noble Truths is to cease creating more additional hurtful karma, to use the word. Yeah, so we're bringing it to cessation. The whole point of the Buddha's teaching is to develop a right understanding so we don't create any more self-referential ego-based experiences. That's the end of karma.
I really can't get this end of karma. I think your karma changes with your knowledge and your experience. It's not ceases, it's not ending. You always have karma in the next moment, but it's a different karma because...
Sure, you can look at it that way.
You're learning the Eightfold Path and Buddha teaching. So to me, as I see it, you still have karma, but your karma is of a better quality or of a different mindset, but it's still there. It never ends.
You can certainly look at it that way. And in relation to what the Buddha's teaching is that you will no longer create the conditions for ego-based unsatisfactory experiences. They will cease. Remember when the Buddha described an awakened human being, he described that human being as unbound or released from craving and clinging, and he described the quality of mind of an awakened human being as calm. Pretty simple and direct. And it's also achievable. So with that calm mind, you're no longer having an... If your mind is resting in equanimity in peace and calm, it's unwavering, then you're no longer creating the experience of hurtful karma. And that's the point of the Buddha's teaching. So it doesn't really... I'm really getting to the heart of it. I want to thank you again, Mary, for bringing that up. It really doesn't matter... it's semantics. We're just playing with semantics. If we say, well, my mind is at peace, and it's been at peace and will stay at peace forever until I die, but there's still karma. Okay. But what does that matter at that point? Mm. I've achieved a goal. I've become a fully mature and awakened human being. Then nothing really matters, does it? Because then I'm living life as life occurs without reacting to it. I've brought to cessation that karma that drove me through ignorance into continued confusion, delusion, and suffering.
Well,
I've reached the goal.
My karma right now is impacted by my ego, which is a negative thing to me. It's what I want to dump, what I want to change. But so that's how I see my karma. I have moments of good karma, and I have moments of not so good karma, because my ego is impacting my karma, and that's where I'm kind of like off track.
Well, but that's the same thing as saying that your present level of mindfulness is impacting your karma.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Yeah.
And if right now in this moment I'm still strongly driven by an overbearing ego self, I'm going to just continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. And if that's the choice, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if I want to develop a more meaningful and peaceful life, then I'll use this moment to continue to incline my mind towards developing these principles and end that type of karma. Maybe it's another way of saying it. Let me just go just a little bit further. Notice that this is just after that. I'll read the last sentence of what I just read previously. Cessation of karma should be understood. The path developing the cessation of karma should be understood. Notice that these are the same words that Buddha uses to describe the truth of suffering. Karma unfolding, whether experienced as pleasure or pain, is an aspect of dukkha and originates in craving and clinging. So you happen to, I know you weren't referring to this, but you happen to mention good karma and bad karma. So we can create as something, a past intentional action drove something that brings us pleasure. If we create an attachment to that, we're creating more karma. And in that sense, karma is hurtful, even though it felt good.
Yeah.
So I kept, it's just a good example, the many, many years that I spent at the bottom of a vodka bottle, a lot of times when I finished the bottle, I felt good. Felt like my karma was doing okay. And I can remember times being blasted out of my mind thinking, life is great. I couldn't get up off the floor, but life was great. That wasn't good karma, even though I felt it as good karma. And we can, and again, I'm using an extreme example, but it could be anything. If we attach ourselves to anything, if there's eye-making in any situation, we're creating distractive karma. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have good experiences. In fact, when we let go of all conditioned reactions to life, all conditioned views, then life is as Maura described it. Even though it was out of right after an agitated moment, Maura described the experience as blissful. That's an awakened human being. It's another way of describing that mind of equanimity. And so it's not this blissful experience that we chase after. It's blissful because we're not chasing anything. We're finally at peace. And we can develop it in the moment after an agitated mind state, or we can develop it to the point where it simply lasts. It runs on. One more quote from the Buddha, and then I'll finish it. In that same sutta, the Buddha continues, intention is karma. Now remember, to tie that into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, the second noble truth is craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. You can say craving originates and clinging perpetuates karma. Intention is the same thing, but the second factor of the Eightfold Path is right intention. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. So in that sense, when we're engaged in the Eightfold Path, then our intention is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. Our intention is to bring karma to cessation. Or that you want to use it, be a little bit more finer with it, hurtful karma, meaning karma that will continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. And just to tie that into the second topic today, rebirth, which is really the same thing, then I am no longer even capable of giving birth to another moment that would incline me towards confusion, delusion, and suffering. I am in control of giving birth to a moment that will lead to lasting peace and happiness. And that's the important teaching on rebirth, and it's the important connection between karma and rebirth. What am I going to give birth to in this next moment? Another, you know, a little bit less even esoteric way of looking at, what's my life going to be like? Well, it's up to me. What am I going to create? And that doesn't mean in the outer circumstances. If I can create within myself, which is certainly possible, we know it is, we take refuge in these teachings, then if it floods and my house is washed away, I'll deal with it, but my mind won't be affected by it. I won't take it personally. Same experience, but a completely different inner experience of it, isn't it? How we live our lives. And that is the importance of the three marks of existence too. Each moment holds the potential to incline our minds towards awakening or through ignorance to continue confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. Another word for karma. So I think that's enough on karma and rebirth today. But what an outstanding class. So,
just going back to my example, I recognized I was, you know, clinging to, I can't be like this, whatever, and abandoning that, you know, and
I can't be like this, and I'll just, and this is just what's occurring. There's no you there.
Right. Yeah. Right. But this is what's occurring. Yes, you could say it in those words.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. What were you going to say?
I was referring to what, and now I can't say the words again because my mind does not hold on to the exact words that you use, and I was trying to place that example that I gave in that context of what you just said, recognizing craving for being, which originated clinging to this is not, I don't want to feel wrong, right, which is a delusional thought, impermanent, it can only be dukkha, it's not self, and just going,
yeah.
And having the so recognizing abandoning craving and clinging and abandoning craving and clinging because that was my intention.
Yeah.
And then this realizing the cessation of suffering.
Yeah.
And continuing to cultivate throughout the next moments mindfulness of abandoning craving and clinging and the cessation of suffering and recognizing it when it arises. And when there's a tightness and an eye that comes up, don't like what that is, and letting that go.
Yeah, well put. Yeah. And that's and again, going back to how we just finished, the Buddha gave us that eightfold path so we can recognize where this is coming up, where craving and clinging, where continued eye making. All these words are really the same thing: craving, clinging, selfing, eye-making, karma, conditioned thinking, anatta, five clinging aggregates. It all points to that one thing that we're doing.
In the immediate experience, it's really obvious. Like the flood I get, but the flood is kind of conceptual for me. But I can see it happening right here and right now a lot.
Yeah.
When it's there and when it's not there.
That's right. Thank you. The Buddha thought very
practical and immediate.
He spent much time considering how to teach this. And that's why I get back to the beginning of this. That's why he took the common teaching of the time of karma and rebirth, which was really taught as something that was imposed by a grand spiritual cosmic kind of conspiracy to very useful and practical terms of you're creating your karma right now. It's not something imposed on us. And so how do we recognize it? He taught us the Eightfold Path to recognize it. Great class. Any other questions about this? How do you like the format, meditating first and then having our discussion after?
I much prefer it, actually, because I think it quiets your mind so that when you are speaking, we're actually concentrating on what you're talking about. We've stopped the...
So you weren't concentrating all those other classes?
The thoughts from the outside world that come with us to some extent, even though maybe we don't intend it to happen.
Okay.
That break, that meditation break, breaks your thoughts from the outside world, and then we've got a more peaceful mind to accept what you're saying, listen to what you're saying.
As long as you breathe slowly.
I found
the meditation after the teaching would, my mind was, I don't know, we can be with an agitated mind, but this particular mind tends to go into overwhelm and with a lot of linguistic information, and then it would be sometimes difficult to settle initially.
Well, I think we're going to continue this for a few practical reasons too. I think especially on our nighttime Tuesday evening class, it's better to meditate. Always better to meditate earlier in the day than later in the day. So we'll continue with this. It lets us get through a little quicker too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll finish with metta. There was a couple announcements I made them before, but I'll make it again. Our Dana dinner is November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's info on the website, and there's a form if you can volunteer. We can use some help with setting up and cleaning up, and also bring in some practical gifts if you can. And some food things. And there's a form, there's an email to send to Maura, just letting her know that you can do that and what you'll be bringing. Maura's going to coordinate that. There's an online streaming Dhamma class every Wednesday at 12 noon now. That's been going pretty well, and it's fun to do it. We had, I think there was five people last Tuesday, but just realizing that we're having a Dhamma class from people that are kind of spread out all over the country was pretty cool. There was something else, but...
Is that interaction?
It is, I mean, that's yes, it is. As long as you have a desktop or laptop computer, meaning not a mobile operating system, and you have if you want to be on screen and you have a webcam and a microphone, which most computers have today, then you can be on screen and be part of the discussion. So, yeah, the technology is pretty amazing. And if not, you can view it through a mobile device. Mm-hmm. And if you have a computer but you don't have a webcam or a microphone, you can still type in a question or a comment too. It's a lot of fun. We'll finish with metta.
Okay.
Find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. And the Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none despise it, deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Peace. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that last line, is not born again into this world? Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.